Well, if you could please take your seats and we'll get started today. Thank you so much for attending our Women We Admire series. As you know, this is sponsored by the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women here at UCOS, where we invite women from not only UCOS, but from around the UC system to come talk to us about their careers and how they got where they are and any pearls of wisdom they care to share with us. We are very fortunate today to have Dr. Rene Navarro with us. He was appointed UC San Francisco's first Vice Chancellor of Diversity and Outreach in December 2010. She serves as a campus expert on diversity initiatives and best practices and leads the effort in recruitment and retention of faculty, staff, students, trainees. She has a long history with the university. She completed her medical school and her residency at UCSF and then joined anesthesia faculty in 1990. Since then, she's held several clinical leadership positions at San Francisco General Hospital, including acting chief of anesthesia, medical director of perioperative services, and chief of the medical staff. Her work in mentoring diversity and women's leadership has been recognized locally and nationally. And she's, in her copious spare time, is also very active in the community. She has served on the San Mateo Commission on the Status of Women and Disabilities and is also a member of the steering committee of the African American Health Initiative for San Francisco County. And before I bring her up, I should have mentioned also we will be having our drawing for our bouquet at the end of the presentation, so the very festive orange bucket there. Please make sure you fill out a little slip and put your name in there if you're interested. And I'd like to welcome Dr. Navarro.
Thank you very much, Margaret, and thank you to the President's Council on the Status of Women. It's a pleasure for me to be here this afternoon to talk with you a little bit about sort of my role, my journey at UCSF, share any pearls of wisdom that I've learned along the way that hopefully you may be able to take a little bit of something from that in your own travels in and about the university. And if not, there's at least some flowers, so you can say, put your name in the hat, and there'll be a bouquet of flowers for you potentially at the end. I just want to start off by saying, you know, I owe a tremendous amount to the University of California, so that's part of the reason it's such a pleasure for me to be here today. I never would have imagined, and I think it's only within the UC system that I can imagine that I would be in the position I am as the first African-American woman to serve in a vice chancellor position at UCSF. And sort of considering where my journey has been, it's all the more amazing. I just wanted to start by telling just a little bit more about myself and how I got to UCSF. I was born in Mobile, Alabama, and as the fifth of six children. We have about 2 hours or so here today. I'll tell you all the details. But I was born in the South, when the South was still gripped by the Jim Crow segregationist laws. And as a young child, I just can remember, you know, the fact that my older siblings were all in segregated schools, and this was well after Brown versus the Board of Education. And I can remember my mom, who at the time worked as a cook, talking about how crazy it was that she had to go in through the back door to cook food, you know, potato salad, and, you know, you got to get your hands to potato salad. You know, that she was fixing food, but she couldn't go through the front door of the restaurant. And I just remember at 4 and 5 thinking that this is just not fair. In its most simplistic form, it was just not fair. And I think that for me has been one of my principles throughout my life, that, you know, fairness is a fundamental right, that we all deserve to be, you know, treated in a fair and equal way. And so I've carried that with me. My family, thankfully, transitioned to Sacramento, California. My father worked for the Air Force, and we were moved out to California, where I started in school, and it was eye-opening for us in so many ways. But my biggest inspiration probably for what I've been able to achieve is the fact that, you know, my mom came out and had always wanted to be a teacher and was able to, after having her sixth child, go to school, finish her degree, get a master's degree, and by the time I was in middle school and high school, she was a teacher. And she was just an amazing woman, a force to be reckoned with. And so as I was completing my high school education and trying to figure out, well, what's the next step? Where do I go from here? Well, my mother kept saying, well, you're going to be a doctor. How do I find a doctor? And you're the one. I decided, you're the one that's going to do this. And it was sort of interesting because she had no idea what that actually meant. I had no idea what it meant. But when I looked at it, I thought 4 years undergrad, 4 years medical school, and 8 years of training after that, I thought, no way. I'm just not doing it. I've never seen a black woman physician. I've heard that there are black men physicians, but I didn't know any of these people personally. But my mom just kept driving us, you know, I'm the daughter of a sharecropper. If I can go from a sharecropper to a teacher, you're the daughter of a teacher. You can go from a teacher's daughter to a doctor. So we went round and round. This went on for, my couple of years in high school. And I was searching professions and decided that pharmacy would be, you know, a reasonable option. I'd get a PharmD degree, I'd be doctor of pharmacy. You know, after having shadowed a pharmacist, I thought this was a reasonable compromise. And my mother was happy with my decision to attend pharmacy school. And so I matriculated at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, and they had this 5-year pharmacy program. Well, in my 4th year, my clinical pharmacy, where you're actually participating as a part of the team and rotating with young residents, I realized, those docs are not that smart. I mean, like, I can do that. I mean, that's what it takes, right? I mean, we can all agree with that, no. That's what it takes, and I certainly have the capacity to do that. And so for me, it was eye-opening in that, you know, I just hadn't had any exposure. I didn't know what it took, and I had to gain some confidence in my own ability to be a part of a team like that. And so I made a decision then that I was going to go to medical school. I finished my pharmacy training, and I started at UCSF in 1982. And, you know, this was pretty miraculous when I was only 12, when I but I was really excited to be there, and I worked as a pharmacist and actually paid my way through medical school because we had Wednesdays off and Saturdays, and so I worked on those days. And it, you know, I didn't have a lot of debt, and the tuition wasn't what it is today, so I was able to get through medical school without too much difficulty. But it pointed out that second principle that I now live my life by, which is, what is the potential? We come with sort of infinite pluripotential. We talk about the cells having, you know, pluripotential, you know, possibilities. And I think individuals are like that as well. We have infinite possibilities, and we let our circumstances and those around us really limit us. And so when I'm reaching out and encouraging students and faculty and staff, it's like, let's just think very, very broadly about what the possibilities are. And people often will find their way when they look at things in that way. And so that was how I got to UCSF. Of course, once I got there, the whole imposter syndrome starts up. The admissions committee make a mistake. They're going to discover I shouldn't be here. How am I actually going to fit in with the other people? Because what I found were that many of the students, well, you know, they were from Ivy League schools, and they were just, you know, there was a socioeconomic divide as well as the racial, ethnic, gender. You know, by all measures of diversity, I was feeling very sort of challenged and a bit isolated in my role as a medical student. And you start looking around, well, where can I get help and reassurance and that kind of thing? And in 1982, quite honestly, there were not a lot of role models and mentors there at UCSF, except for two very notable exceptions that I was privileged to work with. And one is Michael Drake. And Michael Drake, now the chancellor at UC Irvine, along with Jean Washington. Michael Drake was the Associate Dean of Admissions, a brilliant guy, he had been amazed his medical school, and Jean Washington was doing research in women's health. And so the two of them really were a force. You know, they reached out to the students of color. They helped us feel less isolated. You know, they again helped us understand what some of our, you know, potential and possibilities were at the university. And so my third principle is that, you know, we talk about the fact that it takes a village, but I think we should never underestimate the power of one or the power of a couple of individuals. And, you know, we all have power in our positions, and I know sometimes we feel a little powerless, like, what am I going to do in my role? I'm being beat upon by everyone else. But we have power. We have the ability to reach out to somebody else kind of along that pipeline to help them out, to reassure them, to give them a little bit of the insight on the unwritten rules that exist within our workplace, within our environment. And so they were quite powerful, and they were quite powerful. Anyway, but they were quite powerful in supporting us, and that really was a benefit and a lesson that I've learned and tried to embrace along the way myself. But then the next big step for me was, what do you do at the end of all of your training? Where do you go from there? At this point, all I knew was education. You know, 12 years after high school, I'm just finishing my training, and kind of like hit a wall, like, well, can I get a fellowship? Where should I go? And a faculty member reached out to me, Dr. Cedric Bankton. And Dr. Bankton was the chief of anesthesia at San Francisco General Hospital. And his wife, Dee Bankton, was the first woman to be a chair of a clinical department. She was chair of pathology and went on to become the vice chancellor of academic affairs at UCSF. So Cedric was very committed to, you know, embracing and enhancing the diversity of our department. San Francisco General Hospital serves the most vulnerable populations in the city and county of San Francisco, yet the faculty didn't reflect any of that diversity. And so he was very, very committed to that. And he also saw something in me. I thought, really, me? Faculty? I don't think I'm faculty material. When I look at, you know, I hadn't gotten that messaging really from anyone else. With his support, his mentorship, and his guidance, I took the big leap and I joined the faculty. And I started doing my research at UCSF and my basic pharmacology research. I was doing research 2 days a week and working clinically 3 days a week. And over the course of the next 5 years, I got married and had three children. So I was tired. And so I kind of had my back up against the wall. I had three children, less than five, working in two different work sites. I'm looking at my research productivity, and I'm looking at, you know, Liz Blackburn and other, like, Nobel laureates and others, thinking, I'm never going to be competitive in that arena because I'm a clinician, I'm taking care of my patients, I'm a mom. And so I had to figure out, well, is there a place for me at the university that doesn't require that I, you know, kill myself, basically, with the amount of work that I was doing. And so I did some reflecting, and I think reflection is very important. And at the end of that, it was a matter of determining what's right for me, what's my definition of success, and what is going to keep me full and whole and allow me to make the contributions that I want to make and also be, you know, be successful within the UC system. Well, for faculty, there are several tracks that you can take. And so I switched out of the research track into more clinical research, pulled all my work together at San Francisco General. So don't let others really define your success. Reflect, know what your values are, what your passions are, because that's really what's going to drive you to be most successful. And so then over the course of the next several years, I started to focus on it's all about the patient. As a patient caregiver, as an anesthesiologist in particular, you know, your job is all about the patients. And I tell my patients, you know, your surgeon is the technician. They're going to do the technical part. I say technician. Sometimes I say technician. But I'm the one that's taking care of you. From beat to beat, I'm the one. If you need blood, if you whatever you need, I'm your girl. And I'm there with you the whole time. And so you always keep your patient as your priority. And with that, everything else kind of falls into place. And so as I got more involved in looking at systems that didn't work for our patients, you know, and I would present it as, it's not working for our patients. We need to do something differently. And the more questions I asked and issues I raised, the more responsibilities I got. And eventually, I was the perioperative OR director, and I would caution you to be careful what you ask for. That was a fun time. It was challenging working with the surgeons, with the anesthesiologists, with the nursing staff, you know, with the bottom line being how are we delivering the most effective, cost-efficient patient care, but then realizing that everybody has sort of a different view of what it takes to do that. And so that I learned a lot about teamwork there. I learned a lot about the fact that each element of the team is essential. You know, I think early on in my training, my surgical colleagues would want you to believe that it was really all about them. We spent a lot of time, and we've come a long way, I think, in our interprofessional development and teaching our students and our house staff. But it's really about the team, and each element of that team is an important part of it. And so I learned some great lessons about teamwork. And my fourth principle is really remember why you're here. You know, when you get in the middle of something that seems very complex and it's difficult, you can take a step back and say, okay, what is the ultimate goal here? Why are we here? And that'll often help to give you the approach to the problem or to the situation. And so you want to challenge the status quo. So what I learned about both the work of individuals and the work of the team, I was also at the university at a time where women were having challenges. There were numbers of women who were in leadership was not very high at the university, and so the debasing now at the vice chancellor level issues initiated with Mary Krogan, who works here with you now, the faculty climate survey. And the goal of the survey was really to identify what are the issues, what are the women facing on our campus, and how can we make things better. And one of the most eye-opening parts of the survey is that it wasn't just women. You know, we were all in this together, and our men faculty were saying a lot of the things that the women faculty were saying. They love their work at UCSF. It's challenging. It's cutting edge. They love their the colleagues that they work with. But it takes a personal toll on their lives, on their faculty, on their family lives, and we need to do things that are better. And so the survey, I think, was sort of a key turning point for the institution, and we realized at that point that we needed more clarity in the processes. What's the system? You know, what's written in the APM, huge 800-page document, and what actually are the unwritten rules of how you actually navigate, get promoted, and get visibility, and where are the right committees, and why isn't this transparent? Why don't we all understand exactly what it is we need to do and what the expectations are of us so that we can accomplish the goal? And so with that, we really embarked upon a process to try to do that for our faculty. And I venture to say that we've seen some success. That was 2002, and we've just resurveyed last year. And Dr. Marshall will be releasing the results of that survey soon, but we've seen some distinct improvements in the lives of our women faculty. And the same holds true when we look at our staff. So through our operational excellence process, as challenging as it has been for our campus, recognizing that staff, too, need to understand what are the expectations, what's my job, family, what's my next step, how do I get, you know, from this point A to point B, and we all need and deserve clarity around that, because without that, you know, you don't know where your goal is. You don't know exactly what you're being measured by, and so there's not fair, again, to coin my first principle, it's just not fair unless we move forward. So I started doing some work nationally within medicine. I became the chair of the group on women in medicine and science, and looking across our nation. And women are 50% of our students, 38% of our faculty now are female, but only 12% of our department chairs. and 10% of the department deans, college deans across the country are female. And so we say, why is this the case? What's happening? You know, people talk about pipeline, but when you're talking about women's programs, it's really not pipeline, because the pipeline has been at 50%. It's now, when we look at our undergraduate campuses, there are more women than men. So it's not exactly a pipeline issue. But we started to try to tease out what are the barriers to success that women face. And when we started looking at this, we did skill development. So I've participated in a lot of professional development. There are specific skills, negotiation skills, finance skills. There are specific skills that you do need to be successful. But we have a cadre of women and people of color who have these skills, yet they still are not getting the opportunities. And so you say, well, wait a minute, I got the skills. What's happening here? And I've come to the conclusion, and many others have, that the system's broken, right? It's not just that, you know, if we keep waiting to develop our way out of it, to fix the women and fix the people of color, we're not going to achieve the equity that we seek in our workplace. And so we need to fix our system. And so what is it within the way in which we recruit, the way in which we admit, that is biased? What is it about those systems that tend to keep replicating the same kinds of results? And so when you take a step back and you look at that, in the hiring process, there's a lot of data to support the impact of unconscious bias. You know, unconscious bias are the sort of shortcuts we use psychologically. We see somebody, kind of sum them up, you know, they're middle, you know, socioeconomically, they're doing pretty well. They're probably educated. They're not. You know, you kind of make these little shortcuts in your head. And we all do that. And it, unfortunately, the shortcuts often are lead to bias. And there is a implicit association test that you can go online and take. It's done by Harvard, who's been studying implicit bias over many, many years. And what you find when you look at it is that, you know, we're all subject to the same biases, and those biases across the spectrum, we prefer men typically for leadership positions than women. We prefer white over black. For example, if you look at CEOs, this I thought was very interesting, if you look at CEOs in this country, the average height of American men, only 15% of American men are taller than 6. Over 40% of CEOs are taller than 6 feet. I just think that's amazing. Like, you don't set out in your search to get a tall man, a tall white man, typically. You don't set out to do that. But in fact, when someone comes in and they're tall, you just make, oh, tall, commanding. You know, you make a set of assumptions, often without even thinking about it. And so we challenge people to just take the time to understand what your unconscious bias are and have that knowledge about, in the hopes of mitigating the impact of that on your search. And so for our search committee at UCSF, I sit down, I just met with one recently, I sit down with them and we talk about this literature. I give them the website and they're asked to go to the website and do the implicit association test, again, to be aware of what their own potential biases are. And then we also want to define the criteria you're looking for in advance. Because what we also have found is that when you look at a CV, you're going to look at it differently based on the adjectives, he, him versus her. And there are data that supports this, that in fact, you take identical CVs and you put a female name and a male name. The female name CV will, people will write things in the margin, she's, you know, okay, productivity, but is it going to be sustained? And then the male margin, they wrote things like, great, look at this record of publication. Same CV, just changing the adjectives. And similarly, if you look at callbacks, where they, this was a study carried out in Chicago, they looked at putting an African-American sounding name, like Keisha or something, on the CV versus Mary. And they had the CV that was very high quality and the CV that was so-so. The callbacks for people with the name, the African-American sounding name, was significantly less even the high-quality CVs got called back less than the lower-quality CVs of a person, of what they presume might would be white based on the name in the CV. And so, you know, this is something that permeates really essentially everything. But when you're in a position where you're making decisions, I think you have an obligation to take a pause and just be in touch with what your own potential biases are and how can you impact the system. So we've been working quite a bit on what our systems are. How do we do acceptance to medical school? If I just look at your GPA and your medical college admissions test, you might be brilliant on paper, but I don't want you touching my mom. I mean, you know, it's sort of like, you know, it takes more than that skill set to take care of people, right? You have to have cultural humility. You have to be able to understand that people bring different life experiences and that your life experiences really determine your health. And so you have to broaden your vision as you're looking at these things, and I think it's particularly important around healthcare. So we've worked very hard on a holistic admissions process for all of our professional schools, as well as looking at unconscious bias as we're doing all of our search processes. And I think that's part of what we're going to need to do to change things. So at UCSF in 2009, Susan Desmond-Hellman became our chancellor. And Chancellor Hellman comes to us with a wealth of experience in private industry, and she recognized right away the link between diversity and innovation. That, in fact, you need different people at the table to get the best decision. You need to hear the voices of everyone. So her recognition of that fact, she charged a task force to look at how we're doing on our campus around our diversity efforts and initiatives, and she wanted to have somebody as a part of her executive cabinet that was really charged with coordinating all of our activities on campus and really moving us forward in a way that was central to what our vision was and really central to our key goals of the organization. And that led to my selection for this particular position. And we feel that it's critical. If we want to stay on the cutting edge, this is a critical part of it. When we look at the census data in the United States in 2010, 16% of our U.S. population identify as Latino. When you look at race, 97% said that they are of one race, and of that, 12.6% identify as African American, 4.8% as Asian, and 72.4% as white. When you look at the state of California, 38% of individuals responding to the census identified as Latino, 6% Black, and 13% Asian. So when we think about my principle number four, remember why we're here. Who are we serving? You know, what is the reason we're in the business that we are? Around the education and the discovery and keeping our public mission at the forefront, it's imperative for us, I think, to facilitate access of all groups to what the university has to offer. Now, if we exclude underrepresented minority and minority groups, we're going to have over 44% of the population excluded. And so we're never going to be in a position where we have that diversity around the table, so we're going to get the best problem solving, we're going to get the most innovative, creative science out there unless we, in fact, increase the diversity of folks having access to our pipeline. You know, we need to have more on-ramps, more ways for people to access us, and we need to figure out how to keep them here. How do we keep people engaged? How do we support them so that they thrive once they're in this environment? One of the key things for us also at UCSF is the fact that we're in the business of health, right? So we're in the business of health care. And when we look at the nation's health care, there's some disturbing news out there. There was a report by the Institute of Medicine, and the Institute of Medicine did a report back in 2002 looking at, it's entitled Unequal Treatment, Confronting Racial and Ethnic Disparities in Health Care. And a healthcare disparity is a racial or ethnic difference in the quality of health care that are not caused by access. So we recognize that there is a huge access issue. But what this is saying, you have the same access, you have insurance, you have access, yet there's still a difference. So it's unrelated to access or the clinical needs or any particular patient-related preferences. So what is that transition to? That we can go, people of color, majority people, into the same healthcare providers and get different care simply based on, again, probably some of our unconscious biases and some of the stereotypical kinds of thoughts that individuals don't realize that they have, but they carry with them. When they looked at the data around this, they found that the disparities are consistently found across a wide range of disease areas as well as the clinical services, that we find that even when the clinical factors, such as the stage at which the disease presents, the comorbidities, age, and the severity of the diseases are taken into account, that the disparities are found in public and private settings, teaching and non-teaching settings, and that they're associated with higher mortality among minority populations. So we can't, we have to do something about this, right? We're the innovators, we're the leaders, and we're producing in California with our 5 medical schools, our health science, we're producing the leaders in healthcare for tomorrow. So we actually have an obligation to do something about this. For example, when you look at procedural kinds of things, angioplasty, significantly higher rates of angioplasty in whites as compared to African Americans, higher rates of coronary artery bypass surgical procedures, mammography, and hip fracture repair, where African Americans in this particular study had a higher rate of intervention, amputation, people present with diabetes and poor peripheral perfusion, more likely to amputate if you're African American than to do a revascularization, and then bilateral orchiectomy. So if you're a male presenting with prostate cancer, you're African American in this particular study, higher rate of orchiectomy as a treatment as opposed to sort of a sparing kind of a procedure. So these are troubling kinds of findings that exist within our healthcare environment, and we have an obligation to do something about this. And there's evidence that increasing the racial and ethnic diversity of our healthcare professionals is one of the ways in which we can address some of these issues, because it not only adds to the educational environment for all of our students, you know, it increases the cultural competency of all of the members of the class, having a diverse class and having the conversations about it and having this as a part of the curriculum. So we've looked at the curriculum across all of our professional schools to make sure that we have information in our curriculum that addresses the health and healthcare disparities that exist within health in the United States today. So that's very important for us, and we feel it is an obligation for us to move in this direction. So our strategies around the work that I'm doing in diversity are really about attracting individuals to what we have to offer, not just recruiting. So we want to build programs that are attractive for individuals. And one very positive example is the PRIME program, the Program in Medical Education. And in fact, was started here at the Office of the President when Dr. Drake was here as the Vice President, and saying we're going to expand our classes, but we're going to do it in a way that both meets the needs of the patients, the citizens of California, and also will be attractive to individuals applying for our medical school. At UCSF, our program is for the urban underserved population, and over a third of the people who apply to our medical school also apply for admittance into this PRIME program. We only have 10 spots. Not all funded, but we have 10 spots right now in that program, and it's very popular because people are interested in trying to deal with some of these issues for vulnerable patient populations. So through that, we've increased the number of underrepresented minorities actually applying to our medical school classes, and we're looking at a model similarly for dentistry and other professional schools. Then once we have people in our family, what's our culture? what's our culture of inclusion? Is it an inclusive environment? Do people, you know, feel welcomed when they come on board? You know, are they reached? Do we reach out to them? Do we help them understand what some of the complex, really complex rules are that we have within our working environment? We have an obligation to do that. You know, to be family-friendly, gender-friendly, LGBT-friendly, and make sure people feel that and sense that when they come on campus. And one of the initiatives through the Office of the President's sponsorship that you have likely heard about is our climate survey. And so we will all be engaged for the first time in a system-wide survey of faculty, students, and staff about the climate. What's it like to be a staff member, a student, a faculty member, University of California, San Francisco, University of California in general? And I think that's going to be very valuable to us to help us to try to identify where specifically are the hot spots and what are the real challenges. Because when I look at the work for myself, if there is a lot of work to do, it is quite broad and it's quite nuanced. They're not exactly the same issues for women in the staff position as opposed to women in the faculty positions. And so this climate survey, I think, will be a tool to help us really look at that much more carefully, and that will be coming in the fall of this year. We need to educate and train our staff. We've just gone through a process of updating our principles of community. You know, when you're a member of this community, these are the expectations that you're going to live by. And it is an ongoing process, right? Our staff turnover, at least a fourth of our students turnover on an annual basis. And so the students come in and they're representative of the full spectrum of what's happening in our society. And that's great. That's what we want in an educational environment. But we also have to stand by, these are our principles and this is what the expectations are while you're here. I think we need to expand our training on unconscious bias, and we're doing that at UC. Both we're starting with our search committees. We are working with the Academic Senate to get our EQUOP members to serve as equity advisors and really help to make sure that we're covering all of our bases in our education and training around unconscious biases and best practices for our search processes and best practices for our promotions processes. And then we're also working a lot on how you work with folks, how you work with groups in a way that is respectful and in the patient's best interest. And then we also, our strategies include the pathways, you know, and retention, showing folks the pathway to success and, you know, what are the unwritten rules that are there. And, of course, the system has to have accountability, right? If we're talking it but we don't have accountability, then it's going to, you know, fall on deaf ears and it's not going to be sustained. And so the highest level of the organization has to be accountable for making change and for moving things in a positive direction. For 5 years in a row, we have our annual Chancellor's Diversity Leadership Panel, and the Chancellor and the Executive Cabinet present in an open forum to the faculty, students, and staff. And we provide updates about what work has been done towards the diversification of our campus, how we're looking as far as climate, where there are hot spots that have been identified, what's been done in a very specific way to address some of those issues. And that, you know, is a part of our accountability initiative. And we have taken that, you know, to the deans, having to report on an annual basis of what's happening, as well as the CEO of the medical center. And it's a part of their annual evaluation. The department chairs, with their stewardship review, part of their evaluation is what work have they done. And when we do our supervisory training series of courses, one of those is how do you manage in a multicultural environment. You can't be a good supervisor unless you have a skill set in this. And managing women and managing with people of color in your environment. And so those are our strategies, and we feel that transparency is a key part of that. People need to understand what you're doing to build consensus and to get their participation and buy-in to what you're doing. So, you know, my approach is not one that's just focused on race, ethnicity, and gender. My approach is really the approach of culture and inclusion. And so when we talk about that, we're really talking about all of us and that we all have a role in this and that, you know, if we want to sustain excellence, we need to have some transformational changes within our environment. So I have been working, again, with a number of colleagues on our campus to accomplish our goals, and I feel like we are, you know, we are well on the way to doing that. We certainly identified some areas of challenge, and so we have a lot of work ahead of us. But I'm certainly privileged to be in this position because, for me, it really takes me right back to what my first principle was, is that fundamental fairness is really a right of everyone. And so I feel really privileged and honored to be able to work, to spend my time working on issues that will bring more equity, more inclusion and fairness for all of the members of our campus community. With that, thank you very much for the chance to be here today. So it's a battle. It is a challenge. I feel that I have spent a great deal of time with my kids. I was talking to someone yesterday. I was like, yeah, I was a room parent, and I drive on all these field trips. And the benefit that I've had for most of my career is being a faculty member, where I had a lot more flexibility. So I could schedule time off when my kids had activities where I needed to drive on a field trip or be with them at places, or I would take call on the nights or weekends, and then I'd be off the next day post-call and that kind of thing. So I had the flexibility to schedule my time to be with them for the big events. I have had help. I had the same nanny for 12 years who lived with us. I never wanted to take my kids outside of the home. And so having that, and I'm still kind of grieving because she's gone now. And at some point, she transitions from just being the kid's day to being mommy's helper. And so really miss her. But I have had help. But my kids are a big priority to me. And that is part of the reason that I made the conscious decision to step away from the basic research because it wasn't a sustainable life for me. And some said, well, you know, you're just committing academic suicide. You can't. Nobody transitions out of an academic senate position into, you know, you're never going to be. And I said, well, I have to, you know, be true to what my passions are. My oldest daughter has cerebral palsy, and so I have, on top of that, a whole host of issues related to having a child with a disability. And, you know, my husband is an anesthesiologist as well. Thank you. Did you get that? I met my husband there as well. But he's in private practice, and so he has different flexibility. He doesn't work half the time as I do, but different kinds of flexibility in his schedule as well. So he was much more likely to be, you know, home at 3 in the afternoon to get to their practices and stuff. So it's worked out, but it's communication. You know, it's kind of, we got a big communication board and we plan out. I mean, it takes hours of planning to make sure I'm not traveling when there's something critically going on at home. I mean, yesterday I had a volleyball tournament in Alameda. My husband was at a basketball tournament in Pleasanton. And so, you know, you just make it work. Yeah, make it work. I think that Dr. Bankton, I mentioned, was my first sort of true mentor, and he really helped me early on kind of figure out what academics had to offer and how I could navigate a path within academics. And I think I didn't take advantage of mentors the way that I probably should have, because it was fairly late on in my career that I became chair of the group on women in medicine and science, and I realized, there's all these fabulous women all over the place who've gone through these things, and I should be put myself out there a little bit more. But again, it's sort of like, you know, you're afraid to put yourself out there. You don't want to bother anybody. Everybody's busy. And now I know to do that, and I have a cadre. I consider my board kind of, this is my board. I go to different people for different things. But it took me a long time to be confident enough to know that people are really mean it when they say, call me, that they're available to you. You can't monopolize all of their time, but they're available if you have some specific things that you want to reach out to people for. And now I've finally gotten to the point where I do that, and I wish I had done it earlier because it would have saved me a lot of kind of trouble trying to figure out, thinking I'm the only one that's trying to figure out how to, you know, survive with three kids and a full-time academic job. So reach out early and often. And, you know, we've instituted now a mentoring program for all of our, you know, junior faculty and new faculty where you get assigned a mentor that will at least help lay the groundwork. And that's such a critical piece that wasn't really in place when I came on board. And, you know, I didn't know how to set it up for myself initially. It's very important.
You know, a part of the development, I think, of everyone professional is a mentor. Can you talk about what you view a mentor's role is to identify a good
mentor? It's a very good question. I think that, you know, you have different kinds of mentors. And so when we talk to our faculty, which is where I have the most experience about mentoring, it's, you know, you need someone for your science or whatever your scholarship is who can help you understand specifically how to write the grant, get the grant, sort of the technical skills, getting the work done that you need to get done. So it's really identifying someone who understands what you need to get done. So the first step of that is to do a self-assessment. To the extent that you say, this is my, you know, this is my job or this is my task, and this is what I feel my strengths and weaknesses are. So this takes you to take some time, do that self-reflection in an open and honest way, figure out, is it skill development that I need? Is it political savvy? Do I need political capital to get to someone else? What is it that I need to in order to be successful in your particular task or your particular job? And then you identify individuals who you view as having that skill set or who are accomplished in one area or another, and you just ask them if they're willing to have a conversation with you about some of your challenges. And if you find, and so I will often just invite somebody to come and let's just, can we talk for a little bit, let's have lunch, and I want to understand, you know, how you're, I did reach out to the Vice Dean of Academic Affairs, how are you doing this, and what does it really take, and how have you balanced all the things that you're doing, and then, you know, that lunch, you realize we click, so to speak, we get along, and then I ask them to mentor me in a specific area, and that is the way that I've found my mentors. In some instances, there are, you know, very laid-out mentoring programs, and you're just kind of assigned someone, and I think that's a little challenging because the personalities and the sort of the work style, et cetera, needs to match a little bit. But we ask everyone to start with your individual development plan. We have it online for our mentees. Do the self-assessment work first. So you're coming to the mentor and you're giving them something to work with. And, you know, not every mentor, not one mentor is going to fill all of your needs, right? You need a board of directors, so to speak, that if somebody's really good at negotiating, can you come and help me? What do I need to think about? You know, help me with the negotiation piece. Somebody else is really good with the scientific piece, and somebody else has access to the, you know, chancellor maybe, and, you know, you just figure out what your needs are and use your board of directors to help guide you in that respect.
A question that I've got is, I was reading a book called Know Your Value, and I talked about how women sometimes are over-mentored but under-sponsored, and can you talk a little bit more about the differences between a sponsor and a mentor, and how you go about collecting
those sponsors? Yeah, sponsors are great. Sponsors are someone who really takes some ownership to your success, right? I mean, a mentor is vested in you, and they'll help you, and they'll give you the, you know, keys to some of the professional development skill sets that you need. But a sponsor really takes you on and says, I'm going to help make sure you're successful. So when I'm somewhere, I'm going to talk you up. I'm going to help you identify opportunities to get the visibility you need. I'm really going to take you on as my kind of, you know, project, so to speak, and I'm going to help you to be successful. Sponsors are harder to find, I think, in a lot of ways. In part, maybe that there are more insecurities and sponsors are still trying to keep up with their own careers. But if you can identify a sponsor, that's so critically important. And I haven't actively figured out how to search for sponsors. I think that it's all about relationships at the end of the day, and recognizing the value that you bring in an honest way and the value that others bring in an honest way. And with relationship building, some of this will naturally happen. I mean, I think that Cedric Bankton, I think he was kind of my sponsor behind the scenes because his wife became the vice chancellor. I said I was asked to serve on a chancellor's committee. I didn't have that kind of visibility. So I think that he was really behind the scenes kind of sponsoring me and supporting me. But it's important if you can identify a sponsor to do so and really build on relationships like that. And not in a way that, you know, what can you do for me lately, because that's inauthentic, right? And people see through that if you're just trying to use our relationship to further your career. So in a lot of ways, I think it has to come from that individual rather than you're asking them, hey, sponsor me for this and that. Sometimes your mentors will develop into that, but not always.
What do you think your next step is? What kind of questions do you ask yourself?
When can I retire?
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Because I started at 12, right? My next step. You know, I've just come into this role and 2010. So my next step is to see success with a movement in both the culture and the climate of the university, and to have some of our systems change to reflect a much more equitable system. But as far as my own career, I just haven't thought about next steps for my career, other than, you know, I want to keep following my passion. And as long as this is a good fit and I feel that I'm making a difference, if I feel that I'm spinning my wheels or that I'm there just to have a title of doing the work but I can't affect change, then I'll make some adjustments. But I'm driven by outcome, and so I will just continue to push towards the ultimate outcome, that it's a climate where people are saying, I just love to be here. You know, U.S. News and World Report, we're number one, and, you know, health and our hospitals are number one. I want it to be the best place to work. Like, people are happy to be there working in our environment. That would be that's my biggest measure of success, and so career-wise, I have to keep pushing forward. We'll see.
Do you have an opportunity to work in your current role with other campuses, including UConn?
Mm-hmm.
In working through some of the issues related to systemic challenges.
Yes, so the UC has taken it on, and President Udolph has a Council on Campus Climate, Culture, and Inclusion. And so each of our campuses has a similar council, and through that mechanism, we have a group of, now both of our campuses have someone at a vice chancellor or an associate vice chancellor level, and we work both through conference calls and we meet here at the Office of the President periodically. That's how the climate survey came to be, and many of us are around the table for the climate survey work. And again, trying to look at these issues systemically because they're replicated, and similarly trying to find solutions, getting best practices from one institution and sharing them throughout the UC system. We're hosting a round table coming up looking at best practices for faculty searches. And so we're going to be talking about some of the things we've talked about here and what do you have in place in the various institutions. So we are trying to capitalize on the fact that we have all of our campuses and some have figured some of these things out, and we want to share that. I'd like to see us move towards a talent management a little bit around that as well. So people at my institution, we have 1,500 postdocs, and they say, well, we don't hire our own. You know, you've trained here, you need to go out. Well, why aren't we hiring maybe more within the UC system to help cross-fertilize our system and similarly with staff. So I want to see us use our system more to cross-fertilize. Good idea, I think. Any other questions? Thank you. I thank the President's Council on Women for having me here. It's a pleasure, and keep up the good work that you guys are doing here as well.